Thank you, Brother Chairman, my dear brothers and sisters in the Lord Jesus Christ, and my dear young people. Well, last Saturday was matters of prophecy. This Saturday, matters of character and personality. And we're going, God willing, this afternoon to consider together two people that were really quite diverse in lots of ways, and yet the key to each of them, as is the key to all of our lives in the truth, is that whatever our problems, whatever our difficulties might be, that the truth is sufficiently powerful enough, if we can but grasp hold of its principles, to so change us as to become like the Lord Jesus Christ. You know, when you think about the disciples that the Lord chose, they were indeed a fairly diverse lot, weren't they? There was Peter, who was always a little impetuous. Peter, who was always at the front, always with something to say, always with the answer. Maybe it was the very matter of impetuosity that Peter had to try and overcome. John, on the other hand, was a different sort of person. John was a much deeper thinker. In fact, John was a very intense sort of person. That, in fact, was John's problem. His very intensity needed to be tempered and in some way calmed down by the influence of the truth. Thomas, on the other hand, was a man who was a pessimist. Thomas always saw the negative side of life. Thomas always saw the problems. Thomas was never sure. Thomas had to learn to overcome his uncertainty, his own personal self-doubt. Well, this afternoon we're going to look at yet another disciple who had a different problem again, and this man was Philip. And I suppose that if we were to describe Philip, we would have to say that of all the disciples of the Lord, certainly of all the apostles, Philip was the shy one of the 12. That was probably the word that we would use to describe Philip. He was a shy and timid person. Do you know that the Apostle Philip only occurs on 8 occasions in the record of the divine narrative? 8 separate episodes. Four of those occasions are only in the context of his name appearing in a list of the 12. He's found in Matthew chapter 10, in Mark chapter 3, in Luke chapter 6, which is the three synoptic record accounts of the calling of the 12. And he's found in the list of those who assembled in the upper room in Acts chapter 1. So we've got 4 of the 8 occasions that Philip appears in the record. He only occurs in a list of men. That's all we know about him. In fact, nothing at all concerning his character. Although there are a couple of interesting things that we learn in those particular lists. We might just have a quick look at those before we move on. Let's have a look at Matthew chapter 10. So these lists represent the synoptic records of the 12 whom the Lord called to be particularly his apostles. In Matthew chapter 10 and verse 2 it says, "Now the names of the 12 apostles are these. The first, Simon, who was called Peter, and Andrew his brother." Actually, you notice the little semicolon there. So there's two. "Then James, the son of Zebedee, and John, his brother," semicolon. "Philip and Bartholomew," semicolon. "Thomas and Matthew. James, the son of Alphaeus and Lebaeus, whose surname was Thaddeus. Simon the Canaanite, and Judas Iscariot." So in Matthew's account here of the apostles, they are grouped in lots of two. And you'll notice that Philip is grouped with Bartholomew. Perhaps an indication that in some way these two were linked together by some particular friendship. Philip and Bartholomew. So in fact he's number 4 on the list, isn't he? Simon, Peter, Andrew, James, John, Philip. And I suppose in a way that tells us something anyway, doesn't it? And that's this, that although Philip was a shy person, although he may have had a timid character, that doesn't mean that he was necessarily weak or incapable in the truth. He's actually number 4 on the list of 12 men. In Mark's account, in the 3rd chapter of Mark, in the giving of the same list, we have a slight change to the narrative. Whereas in Matthew's account, the apostles are given to us in groups of two. In the record of Mark, we have a slightly different grouping. We're told in Mark's account and in verse 16, and Simon, he surnamed Peter. And James, the son of Zebedee, and John, the brother of James, he surnamed Boanerges, which is the sons of thunder. And you see the colon there. So you have the first three. They were the special three, weren't they? Those were the three that were going to witness the transfiguration, that were going to witness the raising of the little girl, that were going to be present with the Lord in the Garden of Gethsemane. These three were, as it were, the Lord's special troika of disciples. And then follow all the rest. And who are the rest? And Philip and Bartholomew. So Philip's still number four, but notice now that Andrew is brought alongside Philip and Bartholomew on his other side. In fact, we believe that they were Philip's two best friends, Bartholomew and Andrew, whom he developed a special affinity with. In Luke's account, in the sixth chapter, we're told, I think, an important thing concerning the implication of the choosing of Philip in common with all of the disciples. Luke chapter 6 and in verse 13. It says there, "And when it was day, he called unto him his disciples, and of them he chose 12, whom also he named apostles, Simon, whom he named Peter, and Andrew his brother, James and John, Philip and Bartholomew." So there's Philip again as number 4 in the group of the 12. Now I want you to notice verse 12, which is the verse that comes before the selection of these 12. "It came to pass in those days that the Lord went out into a mountain to pray, and he continued all night in prayer to God. And when it was day, he chose 12, and one of the 12 whom he chose was Philip." You know, brothers and sisters, the Lord had deliberated all night about those 12. And Philip was on the list of those whom the Lord chose to be especially an apostle. And yet he was a shy man, a very, very self-effacing, unobtrusive, retiring personality. And the Lord chose him. And that tells us something, doesn't it? Is that the very fact that the Lord had chosen means that irrespective of Philip's personality, he must have been a person capable of manifesting the principles of the truth in his life, irrespective of his personality. Christ chose him as one of the 12, even though he was a desperately shy man. Now, you know, that's really all we learn about the life of Philip the Apostle in these particular lists. We don't learn anything that gives us any idea concerning his character or his attitude or his principles. So, Matthew 10, Mark 3, Luke 6, Acts chapter 1. Now, what is interesting is that of the 8 references that we have concerning Philip, that dispenses with 4, and that must therefore leave another 4. And the interesting thing about the other 4 references is this. First of all, those other 4 passages tell us everything we know about Philip the Apostle. And the second thing is, they're all found in John's Gospel. They're all in John's Gospel. All that we ever come to know about Philip is in the Gospel of John. Now, why would that be? Often we progress, don't we, in our understanding of the truth when we ask questions. Why would that be? That everything that we know about Philip is found only in John's Gospel. It's got to be a reason. Well, if you come to the 20th chapter of John's Gospel, I think we're given a clue. Here at least is, I think, one of the reasons why the whole story of Philip's life occurs only in this particular Gospel record. There is a reason. There's always a reason, isn't there? Here's perhaps one of the key reasons. In John chapter 20, at the end of this particular, in fact we might say, by the way, at the end of his gospel, because The end of John chapter 20 is considered to be, in a sense, the end of the gospel, and chapter 21 is a special postscript chapter. And at the end of John chapter 20 and in verse 30, John concludes his gospel by saying, "And many other signs truly did Jesus in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written, that ye might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing ye might have life through his name." So you see, what John says is that his gospel was written for certain particular reasons. In fact, when we come to the Gospel of John, we notice that it's remarkably different to many of the other gospel accounts. There are many things which Matthew and Mark and Luke record that John never mentions. There's whole sections of the ministry of the Lord that just don't appear in the Gospel of John at all. Now you see, what John is saying here in these two verses is that everything that was written in his particular gospel was for a particular purpose. He was going to show that the Son of God, that Jesus was the Christ, in a certain particular aspect of his Christhood. And as most of you will probably know, each of the gospels presents the Lord in a different way. So Matthew presents the Lord as... How does Matthew present? As a king, quite right, David. Mark presents the Lord from the standpoint of his service, the gospel of the ox, standpoint of a servant or a minister. Luke presents him as a man, the gospel of the man, depicting his humanity. So how does John present the ministry of Jesus Christ? It's the gospel of the eagle. Sorry? Yes, I saw that. It's the gospel of his divinity, isn't it? Exactly what he says here. These are written. He says, the way I've written my gospel, the things that are found in my gospel, the stories that are written in my gospel, are all to help us understand that Jesus was the manifestation of the Father. And that's what his gospel's all about, isn't it? John's gospel is all about the theme of God manifestation, that the Father was manifested in the Son. Now that's a very important clue, because in this gospel, where John is very selective with the drawing of his stories, he tells us everything we know about Philip. And I believe the reason why the story of Philip is found in the Gospel of John is because that's the very lesson that Philip had to learn in his own life. Learning the secret of God manifestation. And if Philip could learn that secret, he would find that he could overcome his shyness and his timidity. He would find that there was a strength and a courage and a power and an ability that lay beyond him that could help him in times when he doubted his own ability because of his shyness. He would learn the secret of what it says in Philippians when it says, "Work out your own salvation with fear and trembling, for it is God that worketh in you." And that he wouldn't have to do it on his own. That the Father is able to strengthen us when we manifest his ways. Now that's what the whole of the Gospel of John is about. And I believe that's why the story of Philip is found in this particular gospel record. Well, let's come to the first of those incidents then. It's right back in John chapter 1. And here we have the first then of the four episodes found in the Gospel of John whereby we learn the story as it's given to us of Philip the Apostle. Gospel of John chapter 1. We're told in the 43rd verse, it says, "The day following, Jesus would go forth into Galilee, and findeth Philip, and saith unto him, Follow me." Now, Philip was of Bethsaida, the city of Andrew and Peter. You know, when you read verse 43, we somehow get the impression that the Lord actually, you see, the Lord already had plans. He actually wanted to move into Galilee, but when you read verse 43 carefully, What it seems to imply is there was something stopping the Lord from leaving. It says that he would go forth into Galilee, but before he could go, there was something he had to do. Before the Lord could move on to Galilee, there was something that required his attention, and that was the selection of a particular disciple that the Lord wanted, and that disciple was Philip. And so verse 43 says, the day following, Jesus would go forth into Galilee, but first he attended to the matter of finding Philip, and he saith unto him, follow me. Now you see how different this is to the story of the two disciples that have already come to the knowledge of the Lord, which we believe to be Andrew and John, in verse 35. You see these two? Again, the next day after, John stood and two of his disciples. And looking upon Jesus as he walked, he said, behold the Lamb of God. And the two disciples heard him speak, and they followed Jesus. And Jesus turned and saw them following. You see, it never says that Philip followed Christ. In fact, it didn't even say that Philip found Christ. It said that the Lord found Philip. You see, Philip was a very shy person. He just wasn't the sort to go putting himself out. And yet the funny thing is that as soon as the Lord called him, Philip did follow. So he was responsive. It wasn't that Philip lacked a spiritual mind. It wasn't that he was unappreciative of the Messiahship of Christ, and yet the record distinctly says, quite differently to Andrew and John, that Jesus had to go and find him. It wasn't the other way round, because that was the character of Philip. He was a very, very shy person. Verse 44 says, now Philip was of Bethsaida, the city of Andrew and Peter. Bethsaida, of course, was one of the fishing villages on the shores of Galilee from whence Peter and Andrew sprang. And Philip obviously knew them. He was acquainted with them. Perhaps he was also of a fishing family. He was of the house of Bethsaida, the city of Bethsaida, the city of Andrew and Peter. Actually, you need to notice that, because generally it's always Peter and Andrew. There would be very few times in the record where the record ever says Andrew and Peter. And I believe the only reason why Andrew comes first on this occasion is because Andrew was going to be a very special friend of Philip. Andrew, you see, was a quieter person himself. He wasn't as dominant as Peter. Andrew had a very gentle personality, and somehow what happened was a friendship sprang up between Philip, the shy man, and Andrew, the gentle man, in the story of the Gospels. But Philip had another friend as well, and his friend was Nathanael, as verse 45 says. Philip findeth Nathanael, and saith unto him, we found him of whom Moses and the law and the prophets did write. Actually, this is a very interesting proof, isn't it? Because, you see, remember that it says in Matthew 10 and in Mark 3 and in Luke chapter 6, Philip is always paired with another disciple by name of Bartholomew. When we come to the Gospel of John, we never hear of Bartholomew, do we? There's no mention ever of Bartholomew in the Gospel of John, and yet there is a Nathanael. And not only is there a Nathanael, but he's obviously a good friend of Philip, because the first thing that Philip does is he goes and has a chat to Nathanael. And so the implication is that the Nathanael of John's Gospel is in fact the Bartholomew of the other three. Bartholomew and Nathanael are in fact the same apostle. Notice the spirit then of Philip. He wouldn't go forth and follow the Lord himself. He wouldn't put himself out. He didn't want to be seen out in the open. But the moment he'd had contact with the Lord, he says in verse 45, he found his best friend and said unto him, we found him. You know, even Philip, you see, had times when he just had to go and tell someone about this man that he'd found. And what did he say? We found him of whom Moses and the law and the prophets did write, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph. And Nathanael said unto him, Can there any good thing come out of Nazareth? Philip saith unto him, come and see. Now, brothers and sisters and young people, you need to take a pencil and underline that word see. because that's the key word to Philip's life. See. Come and see. You might not think so at the moment, but I'll tell you this now, that every time Philip occurs in the divine record of John's Gospel, that word see is always found associated with the story of Philip. And I can understand, by the way, why Philip said what he said, because you see, Philip wasn't a man of words. And when Nathanael said to him, well, who says that this is the Messiah? Philip didn't have the eloquence. He didn't have the ability to say, well, look, there's this reason and that reason and this. He just said, look, so he said the only thing he could do, he said, look, come and see. Because he knew that if Nathanael could have personal contact with Messiah, with the Lord Jesus Christ, that he also would know that this was Messiah. But Philip couldn't explain it. You see, he didn't have the words. So he did the only thing he could. He said, come and experience what it's like. Now you see, the word see in the Greek is the word eido, or eidon, E-I-D-O, or E-I-D-O-N. And in the Greek it has the force of the word see, which we even have in the English. It doesn't just mean to see with the eyes. It means to perceive, to comprehend. Now you see, we use that even in the English today, don't we? Supposing someone says to you, what's this? Or, you know, a problem is put to you. And you say, well, I don't know what that's all about. Someone else comes along and says, well, I'll explain it to you. And so they explain what the problem's all about and show you what the answer is. And you say, I see. What you really mean is, I understand. But the word see means, on this occasion, doesn't it, to see with the mind as well as with the eyes. And I believe that that's what Philip was meaning. He didn't just mean, he wasn't just saying to Nathanael, come and have a look at him. He said, come and see. With all that that word implies, that out of contact with Jesus would come understanding that this was Messiah. But there was a problem. You see, Philip was all excited, which, by the way, was very uncustomary for him. He's not a talkative man, normally. But he was so excited by contact with the Lord that he had to go and tell someone. And so he says, you come and see. But the problem was, who had Philip seen? Verse 45. We found him, of whom Moses and the law and the prophets did write, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph? No, that's not Messiah, Philip. You see, the issue really was, had Philip seen who Messiah was? Or had Philip seen whose son Messiah was? Philip saw Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph, but that wasn't the Messiah. The Messiah was the Son of God, the manifestation of the Father, and the secret of the powers that were held in the hands of the Son lay in the fact that he was the manifestation of his Father in heaven, not that he was the son of Joseph. So you see, the real problem in this chapter was, Philip was excited, but he himself had not yet seen who Messiah really was. Now we're told in the 50th verse of this chapter, as the Lord speaks to Nathanael, Philip's friend, Jesus answered and said unto him, because I said unto thee, I saw thee under the fig tree, believest thou? Thou shalt see greater things than these. And he saith unto him, verily, verily, I say unto you, hereafter ye shall see heaven open, and the angels of God ascending and descending upon the Son of Man. And although that reply may have been given, brothers and sisters, to Nathanael, Philip was alongside listening to those words. And what the Lord is really saying in verse 50 and 51 is that you will see the man who is the manifestation of his Father. And the angels ascending and descending upon the Son of Man were representative of the angelic care and guidance that the Father lavished upon the Son, because he was the Son of God himself. He's the eagle. It's the gospel of the eagle. And the problem is, Philip hasn't seen for himself yet who Messiah is. And when he does, he'll learn the secret of God manifestation. And when he learns the secret of God manifestation, he'll find the key that will help him to overcome his own shy and retiring nature. In the Gospel of Mark, we're brought to the next story, the next incident, and we're going to have to come back, of course, to John's Gospel to find it, but we're going to start the story in Mark's Gospel. This is the next episode where Philip appears. Now, he only actually appears in John's Gospel, but we're going to start our look at this by looking at the parallel account in Mark chapter 6. We're told in the 6th chapter of Mark, and perhaps reading from verse 34 for connection. It says, And Jesus, when he came out, saw much people, and was moved with compassion toward them, because they were as sheep not having a shepherd, and he began to teach them many things. And when the day was now far spent, his disciples came unto him and said, This is a desert place, and now the time is far past. Send them away that they may go into the country round about and into the villages and buy themselves bread, for they have nothing to eat. And he answered and said unto them, Give ye them to eat. And they say unto him, Shall we go and buy 200 pennyworth of bread and give them to eat? You know, it's all how you read the story, isn't it? This is actually quite interesting, this, because you see, I think that the disciples felt that the Lord was a tremendous spiritual teacher, but he wasn't very practical. This was fairly early on in the ministry of the Lord, and the disciples themselves hadn't really found out the real powers that this man wielded. And you see, I think they thought that he was an excellent rabbi, but he was a bit of a sort of, you know, absent-minded professor. And the disciples, of course, being exceedingly practical men, they'd seen that there was a problem of a huge crowd here and no food. Now just come back and read the story again and see if you can sense this. It's all in the way you read the story, isn't it? Verse 35. And when the day was now far spent, you see that little point there? When the day was now far spent, his disciples came unto him and said, in case you haven't noticed, Lord, this is a desert place, and now the time is far past. Send them away that they may go into the country round about and into the villages and buy themselves bread, because, in case you haven't noticed, they've got no bread. They've got nothing to eat. You can almost see the sense of frustration with the disciples, as if the Lord hadn't got any idea about practical things. You know, the Lord did have a very good grasp of practical things. He knew exactly what was going on. And I can just see a smile on the Lord's face. You know, I think there are occasions in the gospel record where the Lord must have smiled. And he smiles at the disciples who thought that he was impractical, and he says, verse 37, no, he says, you give them to eat. And you see how there's a contrast between the disciples' solution and the Lord's solution. The disciples' solution was, verse 36, send them away. The Lord's solution was, give ye them to eat. So who was testing who now? The Lord was actually in full control of this situation. He wasn't unaware of the needs of the people, but there were certain things that the Lord was going to accomplish in this particular story. So the disciples come to him and put the practical needs. The Lord turns around and puts the whole problem back on their shoulders and says, you give them to eat. And they say, well, shall we go and buy 200 penny worth of bread? It says, they say unto him. But that's actually not what happened at all. There was only one person who said that. And that was Philip, according to John chapter 6. If we come back to John's Gospel now, therefore, we pick up that same incident, but now seen through the eyes of John's account, and we find that, in fact, Philip was much more deeply involved in this little episode than Mark's account would suggest. So we're told in the 5th verse of John chapter 6, the same story, the feeding of the 5,000, It says that when Jesus then lifted up his eyes and saw a great company come unto him, he saith unto Philip, Whence shall we buy bread that these may eat? Why do you think he asked Philip? Any thoughts on that? Why do you think he asked Philip? Yes, certainly verse 6, this he said to prove him. That's going to be the issue at stake. I think there's another reason too. If you come to Luke's account, just hold your finger in John and come to Luke's account, which is Luke chapter 9. Now remember where Philip comes from. Philip was of Bethsaida, the city of Andrew and Peter. Now if you come to Luke chapter 9, we're coming now to Luke's account of the same story of the feeding of the 5,000. You see what Luke 9 and verse 10 says. It says, And the apostles, when they returned, told him all that they had done, and he took them and went aside privately into a desert place belonging to the city called Bethsaida. So you see, the particular desert that they were in on this occasion was a desert close by, belonging to the city of Bethsaida. That's Philip's hometown. Now come back to John chapter 6. So here we are in the desert alongside Philip's hometown. And you see, I think what the Lord did therefore is he said, well, let's ask Philip because, well, what did he say? Verse 5 of John chapter 6, he saith unto him, Philip, whence shall we buy bread? And the Jerusalem Bible says, where can we buy some bread for these people to eat? Now you really have to picture this story, don't you? You've really got to imagine this story happening. So here's all the crowd and here's the disciples who've come up and reminded the Lord that the day is getting on and perhaps it's really time he ought to send them away to get some food. And he turns around and he says, no, he says, it's all under control. So he turns around to the apostles and he says, Philip. Philip looks behind him. Philip. No, you, Philip. Me? Yes, you. Philip, I mean, Philip just wasn't the sort of man who liked coming out to the front. You know, Philip would have immediately thought, what have I done wrong? He would have started to itch, he would have started to go all clammy, his face would have gone red, he would have got all flustered, he came out to the front, pigeon-toed, and stood before the Lord as if he was in trouble. The Lord called Philip out, you see, he says, now Philip, you live in this area, Philip, where can we buy bread to feed all these people? Philip, what do you think? Give me an answer. Oh, Philip would not have liked that. That was right out of character for Philip. He was right at the back of the disciples. And to walk all the way through with everybody looking at him, because he's the man who's going to solve the problem, Philip would have felt awful. And the Lord did it deliberately for Philip's sake. Verse 6, And this he said to prove him. For he himself knew what he would do. You see the word knew there? That's eidon, to see. There's our word again. The Lord himself could see what he was going to do. The Lord knew what he was going to do. That's our word eidon. The Lord could see what the answer was, but the question was, did Philip know what the answer was? Well, you can just imagine poor old Philip in this circumstance as this dreadful problem was placed upon him to solve. And Philip says in verse 7, and oh, you can just about hear Philip saying this, can't you? This sort of, you know, away goes the calculator. And then he says, phew. He says, 200 penny worth of bread's not sufficient for them, that every one of them may take a little. Now do you know that in Matthew chapter 20 and verse 2, we have the parable of the labourers that went out into the Lord's vineyard for hire. Can anyone remember what their hire was for a day? Their wages were a penny a day. Matthew 20 verse 2. So a penny was a day's wage. So 200 pennies, well, in fact it's about a year's salary, because you see by the time you take off public holidays. And there were some, don't forget, there was Passover, Pentecost, Tabernacles, Feast of Trumpets, Day of Atonement, etc. There were a few, you see, in the Jewish calendar. By the time you take those off and Sabbath days and so on, 200 working days at a penny a day, that's about a year's salary. That's a lot of money. Philip says, we just haven't got that much in the purse. Not surprising, since Judas was looking after the purse. And he just absolutely couldn't cope with the dimensions of that problem. But you see, Philip had made a mistake. You see, the miracles centered around a practical problem of everyday life. Food. And Philip approached the problem from a natural viewpoint. He made a mental calculation of the sum involved and he concluded that the case was absolutely hopeless. He said there is no solution. It cannot be done. But the one thing Philip didn't see was a spiritual dimension to a natural problem. You know, brothers and sisters and young people, we should never imagine that our everyday problems in life are unrelated to divine principles. They are. Every problem that we come across in daily life, be it at school, be it at work, be it with friends, be it with money, be it with health, always has a spiritual dimension to that problem. You know, we all believe in the truth, don't we? We all believe that the truth should come first. We do. We do believe that. And yet somehow what happens in daily life is there we are, busy at work, and something happens in the course of everyday life, and as for spiritual things, they fly out the window because we say, we've got a problem to sort out here. And it's as if the truth's got nothing to do with everyday problems. Oh, yes, it has. In fact, the very first thing that we should say whenever we have a problem in life, whatever it is, what would God want me to do here? Is there a spiritual answer to this problem? Is God testing me? Is there a reason why we're going through this? Is there a Bible answer? Is there a scriptural principle that I could apply? What will be best for the truth in trying to deal with this particular problem? You know that you can do that even in everyday life? Not only can we, but we should. We should approach all life's problems from the perspective of the truth. Philip didn't do that. He simply saw it as a natural problem, calculated the odds and said it was absolutely impossible. Do you know the one thing that Philip should have done? Do you know what he should have said? In verse 7? What he should have said was, 200 penny worth of bread is not sufficient for them, that every one of them may take a little, but thou, Lord, knowest. Isn't that what he should have said? Didn't he have trust in Messiah? You know, Melva Purkis has an excellent comment in Life of Jesus at this particular moment of the Lord's ministry. This is what Melva Purkis says. He says, had Philip learned since those early days that looking upon Christ, he was looking upon the Father, that the power of the God of Moses was manifest in his Son, and the answer that was going to come forth on this occasion would show that the Lord was able to solve natural problems by spiritual means, because he was the manifestation of his Father. Now look how the story unfolds. Andrew comes along and says, there is a lad here with 5 barley loaves and small fishes. Jesus says in verse 10, make the men sit down. There was much grass in the place. The men sat down, a number about 5,000, and Jesus took the loaves. And when he took the loaves, Matthew chapter 14 says that he did one other thing that John doesn't record. Now without turning it up, see if you can guess what it is. It's in between the phrase, he took the loaves, and he gave thanks. One further phrase. Anyone like to have a guess? Sorry? Break the bread? Sorry, did you say prayed? Matthew says he looked up to heaven. When it says he gave thanks, of course, that was the prayer and the seeking of the Father's blessing on the loaves. So when we put the accounts together, what happened was Jesus took the loaves. Now remember, he'd asked Philip to prove Philip. He himself, the Lord, knew what he would do. He saw it quite clearly. He took the loaves, one can imagine, perhaps in full view of Philip, as Philip looked on, amazed. He took the loaves, and this is what, it's not my power, Philip. I haven't got any intrinsic power to multiply loaves. Even the power that I have as the Son comes from the Father. And you can have that power too, Philip, if you believe the Father can work in your life, as he does in mine. Wasn't that the secret? Philip had to know whose son Messiah was, and he wasn't the son of Joseph. He was the manifestation of his Father, and therein lay the secret of the power of the Son of God. And if Philip could learn that secret, he would overcome his own problems in life. The secret of God manifestation. And the Lord looked up to heaven as if to acknowledge that therein lay the secret of his own power, and asked for a blessing from the Father, and the loaves were miraculously multiplied. And that was done, brothers and sisters, at least in part, for Philip's sake. And only John tells us that. In John chapter 12, we come to the third episode where Philip occurs. We're told in the 19th verse of John 12, "The Pharisees therefore said among themselves, Perceive ye how ye prevail nothing? Behold, the world is gone after him. And there were certain Greeks among them that came up to worship at the feast." See that little mark alongside verse 20? What does that mark denote, by the way? You know what that mark denotes? A new scroll, or a new section in the scroll, a new beginning perhaps in the scroll. We need to be careful with those marks, because I think what happens is, you see, they have been inserted later on, those scroll marks. In fact, the chapter divisions and even the verse divisions that we have been inserted much later on. I think sometimes as a result of that we sometimes miss the flow, the contextual flow of the narrative. Do you know that verse 19 and verse 20 really flow together beautifully? Look at it. "The Pharisees said among themselves, Perceive ye how ye prevail nothing? Behold, the world is gone after him, and there were certain Greeks among them that came up to worship." And there was the world, the non-Jewish world, certainly all going after Messiah. There they were. They were in Jerusalem at that very time. Indeed, the whole world had gone after him. And these Greeks, in verse 21, came to Philip, which was of Bethsaida of Galilee, and desired him, saying, Sir, we would see Jesus. They came to Philip. Any idea why they came to Philip? Now, there's a good question. Why do you think the Greeks came to Philip? Why wouldn't they come to Peter? Or John, one of the other more important disciples? Why do you think the Greeks approached Philip? Well, for homework, you might like to think that one through. I think one of the reasons is because Philip's a Greek name. And by the way, so is Andrew, Andreas. They're both Greek names. These two disciples had Greek names. Perhaps these Greeks thought that maybe that there would be some basis of perhaps a better understanding, a better reception, if they endeavoured to approach the Lord through at least a disciple that had a Greek name, that they would be more inclined to at least listen to them. So they came to Philip. Now you see what they said. They said, "Sir, we would see Jesus." There's our word again. We would see Jesus. And they asked Philip for that. But the question was, had Philip seen Jesus as the Son of God? And they came and asked Philip if they could approach on that basis. Notice how shy Philip was. Philip didn't want to go and approach the Lord directly on that matter, so he went and he spoke to his friend, Andrew. He said, "Look, Andrew, I've got a problem. These Greeks, they want to see Christ. What do you think we should do?" Andrew says, "Well, I think we're right. Look, we'll go together." "Oh, thanks very much." And so it says, and Andrew and Philip tell Jesus. So you see, who came to Jesus first? It was Andrew, you see. So they came to Philip and said, "Sir," so they were very respectful, these Greeks, weren't they? They were obviously quite sincere in their approach. They said, "We would see Jesus." Philip goes to Andrew, and it's Andrew and Philip, tagging along behind, that actually go and see Jesus. He was a very shy man, was Philip. And verse 23 says, "And Jesus answered them." So whatever the record is in John 12 that follows on, at least in part, the words that the Lord speaks constitute an answer to the request of Philip and Andrew that the Gentiles, the Greeks, might come and see the Lord. And in the context of those words that follow concerning the suffering and the sacrificial death of the Lord, we read that the Lord says in verse 26, "If any man serve me, let him follow me. And where I am, there shall also my servant be. If any man serve me, him will my Father honour. Now is my soul troubled. And what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour. But for this cause came I unto this hour. Father, glorify thy name." Then came there a voice from heaven saying, "I have both glorified it and will glorify it again." The people, therefore, that stood by and heard it said that it thundered. Others said an angel spake to him. Jesus answered and said, "This voice came not because of me, but for your sakes." And what was revealed on that particular day, when the Gentiles came and said, "We would see Jesus," and Philip came and brought that request before the Lord, was a distinct indication of the manifestation of the power of God towards his Son. And heaven itself thundered with the voice of God as he spoke directly with his Son. If ever there was an indication of a Son and a Father that were inseparably bound together, it was this man in prayer to the Father and the divine voice of God that thundered in response. And therein lay the secret to this man's strength. He was the manifestation of his Father. Could Philip see that? How could he ever bring the Gentiles to see Jesus if he himself had not yet worked out whose son Messiah was? And if he could, what a great lesson he would learn for the development of his own character. John chapter 14. So here we are now in the upper room. The Lord is addressing his disciples. He says in the sixth verse, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man cometh unto the Father but through me." In other words, he was the channel of communication of things divine. The way, the truth, and the life, we believe, of course, is an allusion to the contents of the ark. The manna, representing the way, representing mental transformation. The tables of stone, representing the truth, standing for moral transformation. The rod of Aaron, which budded, signifying life, and pointing forward to physical transformation at the coming of our Lord. And these are the things by which a person is transformed ultimately to become a son of God for themselves. Jesus says, "You can only come to the Father through me. I am the channel of things divine." And verse 7 says, "If ye had known me, ye should have known my Father also, and from henceforth ye know him and have seen him. And there's our word again. Philip saith unto him, Lord, show us the Father, and it will be sufficient for us. Just like Moses did, remember? Show me thy glory. Just for a moment, could we just have a glimpse? Just to help us. Just for a moment, Lord, show us the Father. And the Lord turned to Philip and said, verse 9, he said, Have I been so long time with you, and yet hast thou not known me, Philip? He that hath seen me hath seen the Father. And how sayest thou then, show us the Father? He was the manifestation of the Father. You couldn't have a fuller revelation of God manifest upon the earth. Here was the express image of the character of the Father upon the earth. Brother Thomas says in Phanerosis, No man hath seen the Father's spirit in his unveiled splendour, but veiled in the flesh, the veil of the covering, he that discerned him who spake to Philip saw the Father. The Father's spirit is embodied power. Paternal power implies offspring or sons of power. It is power emanating from the Father, corporealized in one of a multitude, but never separated or detached from the focal center. In other words, all power comes from the Father, but it radiates out into offspring. And here was the most preeminent offspring of them all, Jesus, the Son of God, not the Son of Nazareth, the perfect manifestation of his Father. And so, of course, what Jesus was saying was, looking from verse 7, was that if to know Jesus was to know the Father, then also to see Jesus must be to see the Father. It's the secret of God manifestation, isn't it? Philip hadn't seen him. He really hadn't yet seen whose son Messiah was. But the day would come when Philip would. In verse 12 it says, Verily, verily, I say unto you, he that believeth on me, the works that I do shall he do also, and greater works than these shall he do, because I go unto my Father. And the day was coming when Philip would see that Jesus was not the Son of Nazareth, he was the Son of God. And that in learning to manifest the Father's will and the Father's purpose, that the Lord had also enjoyed the Father's strengthening hand, and that if he, Philip, was able to walk in God's ways, then he also could ask for divine help and for divine strength and for divine assistance. He might not be a son of God like Jesus was, but he could receive the help of his Father, and if he could just trust in that, he could overcome his difficulties. And I believe he did. In fact, we're told, according to tradition, that Philip laboured in the area of Bithynia and ultimately lost his life through being a martyr for the sake of the truth. He was one of those men in the Acts of the Apostles who went forth and who turned the world upside down, says Acts. Remember that marvellous phrase? These which have turned the world upside down. Little Philip, the shy, retiring, quiet man, was a brave warrior for the truth. Once he'd learnt the secret of John's gospel, that in learning to manifest the Father in our lives, the Father will strengthen us to overcome our problems. And that we don't have to do it all on our own. That none of us have sufficient strength really to do what we need to do. That our life in the truth is not based on human resource or human power. That all of us are frail when it comes down to the final analysis of things. And that we all depend upon the Father. Not only shy people, we're all the same. If Philip could just learn to trust in God's power to work in his life, he could overcome his shyness. And I believe he did. You know, brothers and sisters, one of the things that's impressed me over the last few years, and it's a very important thing, and I believe that this was one of the reasons why Philip was chosen. You see, we're not chosen in the truth because of our natural ability or talent. We are chosen for how the truth can change us. You just stop and think about that for a moment. You see, you can have someone who is very industrious, maybe a sister, and she's always at the ecclesial hall doing things. She's making the supper, and she's baking cakes, and she's organising things, and she's cleaning the hall, and she's arranging flowers, and she's out helping other people, and she's a very industrious person. And people say, what a marvellous attitude, what a tremendous spirit for the truth. It may be, but it could be that she was just a busy person by nature. Some women are born that way. They're naturally industrious. Now you see, there's nothing wrong with that in the truth. That's a marvellous thing. But the question is she doing it in the truth because of the motivation of the truth, or simply because that's what she's like anyway? And she would have been like that even without the truth. Do you see what I mean? It's not our natural ability that God's interested in. It's how the truth has changed us. It's in fact the areas of weakness that we have that have been transformed that the Father's interested in. What about the brother who's very quiet and humble? And people might say, you know, he's a brother, he's a marvellous spirit. He's so humble. Well, it might be that just by nature he's a self-effacing person. He might have been like that even without the truth, mightn't he? Do you see what I'm getting at? You see, it could have been that that was his natural personality, and that he's not so much doing it because the truth's made him humble, but he would have been like that anyway. It's how the truth has changed us. That's the really important thing. Not the natural talents we've already brought to the truth. It's the areas of weakness that we've learnt to overcome. It's the principle of how the truth has transformed our thinking. It's how we've overcome our deficiencies in nature. It's how we've overcome our problems with regard to our character. It's how we've learnt to control our personality. It's how we've allowed the Word to direct our thinking, to become Christ-like in our spirit, irrespective of what we were like. Isn't that what the truth's all about? How the truth changes us. That's the lesson of Philip's life. And the Lord went up into a mountain one night and chose 12 after thinking about those 12 men all night, and he chose Philip, who for all his shyness was a spiritually minded man, and who, if he could but learn to trust in the Father and to walk in the Father's ways, would find the power that would transform his life from a shy and quiet person to a brave warrior in the truth. We all need to take hold of that transforming power, don't we, brothers and sisters, to trust in the Father's ability to work in our lives, to let the truth change us, and not to rest simply on our natural abilities. To allow the truth to overcome our weaknesses. To seek to manifest the Father in all that we do. That's the lesson that we have to learn in common with Philip the Apostle, who on that memorable day turned and said to the Lord, "Show us the Father."